Today at Reader's Corner, Gilda R. Daniels, author of Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is considered one of the most effective pieces of legislation the United States has ever passed. It enfranchised hundreds of thousands of voters, particularly in the American South, and drew attention to the problem of voter suppression. Yet in recent years, there's been a continuous assault on access to the ballot box in the form of stricter voter ID requirements, meritless claims of rigged elections, and baseless accusations of voter fraud. In her new book, Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America, Gilda R. Daniels examines the phenomenon of disenfranchisement through the lens of history, race, law, and the democratic process. Gilda R. Daniels is an expert on voting rights, serving as a deputy chief in the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division's voting section in both the Clinton and Bush administrations. She has more than a decade of voting rights experience, bringing cases that involve various provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the National Voter Registration, and other voting rights statutes as well. Gilda Daniels, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with what you call a cycle of voter access and denial that is an integral part of our history. Help us with that. Give us a thumbnail sketch.
Great. I'm so glad to be here today to talk about a very important issue, which is certainly the access to the right to vote. In the book, I talk about what I've identified as cycles of voter suppression. We have these periods of great progress that are followed by periods of regress, right? And where there's a pushback, certainly in regards to voter access. And we see that throughout our history. For example, we can go to the period of Reconstruction. During the period of Reconstruction, where we had the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and you saw Black men receive the right to vote. And they took on that responsibility wholeheartedly. And in many places, literally changed the complexion of the electorate and of elected officials. In places like Mississippi, they were able to elect two African-Americans to the United States Senate. We have not had two African-Americans from the same state since the late 1800s. And we've only had two African-Americans from the South since 2021 with the election of Raphael Warnock from Georgia and Tim Scott, who's a senator from the state of South Carolina. So from the late 1890s to 2021, the South was not able to elect two African-American senators to the United States Senate. However, they were able to do so shortly after certainly the ratification of the Civil War amendments with the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments. But when you saw that, so that's an example of the progress, right, during that period. And then you saw pushback. You saw the Southern legislatures pass laws like poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and other laws that were meant to strip certainly African-Americans in particular of their right to vote. And it was very effective. So we had the great progress, a very short period of time from the late 1880s, certainly after the passage of the Civil War amendments, we're talking 1870 to about 1890. And then you saw the passage of these suppressive measures like literacy tests and poll taxes. And you saw places like Alabama that had approximately 100,000 African-American men who registered to vote in 1901. And then after the passage of these laws around 1906, there were only 41 Blacks registered. And unfortunately, we're seeing the same thing today. Well, we saw great progress with voters of color coming out and voting in large numbers in the 2020 election. And now we're seeing that it is being met with this cycle of regress, where you're seeing laws being passed. As a matter of fact, today in the state of Texas, they're actually debating whether to pass a very restrictive voting rights law that will, again, make it difficult and harder, and in some instances, almost impossible for people to register under some of these laws, as well as to cast a ballot. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the foundational guarantee to vote, and that would be certainly the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and how it opened the gates for free and fair access to the polls. Share with us what that bill really does, that law really does, and then, of course, we're going to get into what happens to that law over time, right on down to last week, or we'll just say recently, since this program will air at various times over the next few months. But please share with us the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Well, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as you said in your introduction, is considered one of the most effective pieces of legislation in the history of our country. It's important to know why the Voting Rights Act was necessary. It was necessary because, as I mentioned earlier, certainly after Reconstruction, where you had Blacks being elected to state, local, and federal levels, and then you had the institution of laws like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses that were meant to disenfranchise Black voters, and those laws were implemented and sustained over decades to the extent where voter registration in places like Mississippi for Black voters was less than 10%. And places like, certainly in other parts of the South as well, where you had white voters registering at, let's say, the 60 or 70 or 80% levels, and Black voters were only able to register at much lesser levels, around the 10% levels. And that was because of these literacy tests. In the book, I give some firsthand accounts of persons who actually had to take a literacy test. One of them is Miss Myrtle, who lived in Montgomery, Alabama, who had a degree from South Carolina State University and had a master's degree as well, and moved to Montgomery, Alabama, went to register and was asked how many bubbles were in a bar of soap. And her answer was around 100. She was told that that answer was wrong. But that's an example of the kinds of literacy tests that were being used to disenfranchise Black voters. Literacy tests were also in place in places like New York, where Ms. Menez, who is the grandmother of one of my colleagues, had moved from Puerto Rico to New York, and she had to take a literacy test before she was allowed to vote in the state of New York. So these measures were used certainly to keep Black and brown voters from accessing the right to vote. And the Attorney General for the United States at that time, Attorney General Katzenbach, was finding it difficult to try to chase down each of these laws in all of these various states and all of these various counties. And so he certainly petitioned Congress and the United States. And there's also, as you know, the civil rights movement, of course, was pushing voting rights. Martin Luther King Jr., as early as 1957, gave a speech that said, "Give us the ballot," which talked about the many ways, the many conniving methods that were being used, is a word that he used, the conniving methods that were being used to disenfranchise Black voters. So there was a need for the Voting Rights Act. And it was certainly Bloody Sunday, where marches led by Congressman John Lewis and Reverend Hosea Williams marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and were beaten back by law enforcement officers. And the country and the world watched. And it was certainly Bloody Sunday that was pivotal, I think, for President Lyndon Baines Johnson, as well as the Congress, to realize that they needed to address this issue of voting. So the Voting Rights Act of 1965 had two primary provisions. Section 5, which required jurisdictions that had in place some of these disenfranchising methods as of November 1st, 1964, and less than 50% of their electorate was registered to vote, were required to submit any and every voting change to the United States Attorney General for approval, or what's called preclearance. So that was a very important part of the Voting Rights Act. There's also Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is essentially a nationwide prohibition against voting discrimination. Those two pieces were certainly very important in ensuring that voters of color in particular, but certainly all voters, had access to the right to vote, because the Section 5 preclearance, those jurisdictions, and it was primarily the South. It was, you know, parts of North Carolina. It was all of South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, parts of Florida, all of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, right? And those certainly former Confederate states primarily, as well as parts of New York and other states that were covered jurisdictions and had to get approval before those changes were made. And that included things such as moving a polling place across the street to a congressional redistricting. And so that provided a safeguard for many jurisdictions to ensure that their legislation did not put voters of color in a worse position, which was the standard. We don't have Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act anymore because of the 2013 United States Supreme Court case, Shelby County versus Holder, where the United States Supreme Court said that the triggering formula, the test certainly to determine whether or not a jurisdiction was covered, was outdated. So the Supreme Court said that test, meaning whether or not the jurisdiction had a disenfranchising device as of November 1st, 1964, and whether less than 50% of its eligible persons were registered to vote, was an outdated trigger. So it told Congress to change the formula, to update the formula. Congress has not yet done so. I'm sure we'll get into that later.
You're listening to Gilda Daniels. She's the author of Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. So while the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was in force up until 2013, I think you do point out that there was a significant increase in the number of African-American voters, in the number of African-American office holders, and even Latinx office holders. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was monumental. And once again, you know, changing the complexion of the electorate. We certainly saw those areas where Black voters were under-registered, right, and in many places unrepresented. That literally changed, and now you see in many parts of the South, particularly with voter registration, you have parity amongst voters of color and white voters. So, you know, getting rid of certainly literacy tests, poll taxes, and those kinds of mechanisms, which were certainly historically disenfranchising, with the Voting Rights Act, that certainly enabled people of color to register. Because remember, part of the Voting Rights Act required federal officials to come to these states to register voters because the states had refused to actually register Black and brown voters. Mm-hmm. So the Voting Rights Act was monumental in ensuring that Black and brown voters had the ability to register to vote and to cast a ballot. Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure, Gilda, that we squeeze into this very limited time we have some of the issues that our readers are hearing every day as we hear these cases coming out of the Congress. And one is voter ID laws. You provide the reader a history of voter ID laws, but I wonder if you could just sum up for us the myths of those voter ID laws. That's what I thought was so impressive about your treatment of this.
Well, there's a number of myths in regards to voter ID, and one of them is that everybody has an ID.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and people say, oh, well, you need an ID to go to the movies and go to the bank and those kinds of things. But everybody does not have an ID, and everyone does not have a driver's license. In 2006, when Georgia put forward its what it called restrictive voter ID law, there were approximately 25% of African Americans did not have driver's licenses. 25%. Yet the state limited the acceptable forms of identification to a driver's license, military ID, government issued ID, passport, right? So I call certainly those kinds of laws that severely restrict the types of identification that you can provide to certainly determine your identity as restrictive voter IDs. And those are the ones that certainly advocates and others who are fighting to say you can expand the types of acceptable voter identification and still maintain the integrity of the system. For example, there are states that allow you to not only provide a driver's license, passport, military ID, but something that justifies, that demonstrates where you live. Like you can bring your utility bill, an electric bill, another form of photo ID, right? A picture of your Costco card, your Sam's card, right? Those, something that has your picture and your name. And then as something that had, and in other places you have to make sure that you justify your address by bringing a piece of mail that has your address and your name. So all of those are ways that you can expand the means and ways in which people can demonstrate their identity. But when we limit it to just two or three or four forms of identification, we find that that certainly has a disenfranchising impact, particularly on voters of color. Mm-hmm.
The other one that really got me, I got to the part of your book where you described voter purges. Now, you know, I read about voter purges like the rest of us. But I read where in at least one state, if a voter doesn't vote in 2 years, he or she is just kicked off the rolls and has to go through the whole process again. And I love the quote you had from the guy who said, "Do you mean if I don't buy a gun in 2 years, the Second Amendment can no longer protect my gun rights?" And again, I want you to share with us your thoughts on these voter purges. They obviously can be traced way back to what you call the redemption issue or the redemption period. But I think these voter purges are just completely out of control. So please help us understand where that's going.
Well, certainly the people who administer elections have to have the ability to clean up their voter registration lists. And many of them conduct voter purges. And they conduct it for many reasons, right? You can purge voters because they are deceased. And people who have moved, right? You can get a notice from the Department of Motor Vehicles that someone has moved, and that information is relayed to election administrative officials, and then you're removed from the list. But another way, and certainly another disparaging way that people are purged, is for not voting. And in places like Ohio and other states, where if you miss two federal elections, let's say a midterm and a presidential election, let's say you didn't vote in the midterm and you didn't vote in the presidential election, they can remove you from the voter rolls. And then you have to then re-register and get placed on the rolls once again. So you didn't move, you didn't die, but because you were not inspired or for whatever reason chose not to vote in two elections, you would be purged. And it was a very compelling quote from someone who was actually purged in the state of Ohio, who said, "They don't take away my right to buy a gun if I don't buy a gun. So why do they take away my right to vote if I don't vote?"
Now, didn't the Supreme Court in the Husted case deal with this?
In the Husted case, the Supreme Court said that the way Ohio purged voters was okay. And so that it certainly led other states to do the same. So the Supreme Court has certainly sanctioned voter purges. And, you know, I certainly don't agree with that decision because it's actually used a part of the a federal statute that specifically said that you cannot be removed for not voting. Yet the Supreme Court said that the way that Ohio did it by sending a piece of mail was okay. So since you said it was that Ohio wasn't purging people for not voting, it was purging people for not returning a piece of mail. And I was like, that's okay.
Yeah,
like, that
right.
Should not be okay.
Exactly.
There's lots of mail that I don't return. So I think we should consider the right to vote as fundamental, and that we shouldn't be able to lose it so easily.
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court of today clearly doesn't consider the right to vote to be fundamental. I mean, you might as well take a minute here to explain the most recent Arizona case.
Well, in Arizona, the Brnovich case, which the Supreme Court heard this term and issued its opinion recently, involved two mechanisms: out of precinct voting and collecting ballot, and the ability to collect ballots if you weren't like a postal worker or relative and some other entities. So those two requirements were litigated, and certainly the lower court said that the way that Arizona had written its laws in regards to persons who, not counting ballots that were out of precinct. And so an out of precinct balloting is you go to the wrong precinct and cast a ballot. So in Arizona, they won't count that ballot. And in Arizona, that was about 40,000 ballots.
Wow.
So think about that, right? Yeah. That's 40,000 ballots. Yeah. And as close as elections have been, certainly recently, that makes a difference. And it was found that it disparately impacted voters of color, that it was voters of color whose ballots were being discarded.
Mm-hmm. And I might point out here, and I think I learned this either in your book or maybe a recent article I read, that as far as ballot collection is concerned, and that's what you called it, the Republicans who are attacking it call it ballot harvesting. And what, of course, it is in Arizona, for example, as I understand it, is in the Navajo Nation, to use just one example. It's very difficult for these people to get to the ballot box, to get to the polling place, so people collect their ballots for them and take them to the polling place. And that's precisely what the Supreme Court said they will not allow anymore. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And, in communities like Native American communities where the polling places are so far away, right? And, people say, oh, everybody has a car. No, everybody does not have a car. And some places don't have mass transit, right? So these are very rural areas. And so the Supreme Court said that Arizona, it within its authority to say that only certain people could actually collect ballots. So the Supreme Court looked at those two issues and looked at Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which I mentioned earlier, because the lower court said that those two provisions essentially violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So the Supreme Court has made it harder to bring cases under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. While it eliminated Section 5, it has now certainly demonstrated that Section 2 has been severely weakened. And one of the key points is that the court has essentially said that the state doesn't have to prove anything, that the state can say that voter fraud is the reason for passing legislation like ballot collections and out of precinct voting, and say that they were doing it because of voter fraud or to increase voter confidence. And the court said that was okay. Mm-hmm. Because the state of Arizona said did not have one instance of voter fraud, did not provide any evidence of voter fraud. And the court said that it was okay. They were doing it because they had heard that there was voter fraud somewhere else in the country.
I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. I'm talking to Gilda Daniels. She's the author of Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America.
Which is amazing. But the burden for advocates has increased exponentially because now, even as I said before, for example, with Arizona and the 40,000 ballots, the court said, that's not enough. It's got to be more than that. That there are burdens that go along with the right to vote, and it can't just be a mere inconvenience. Mm-hmm. Essentially they say that it's easy to vote in. That was the first line of the opinion, that it's easy to vote. It's easy to vote in Arizona and that it's open and equal, but it is not. Mm-hmm. And even when you can show that there are communities, and particularly communities of color, that are disparately impacted or certainly differently impacted, or that it's harder for those communities to cast a ballot, the court said that that's not enough.
Tell us about the Right to Vote Amendment movement. And is that at all some hope for the future as to how this all works out?
Well, in the Right to Vote Amendment movement, I think it's hopefully it will become a movement. It certainly has been a movement, but hopefully we'll get some traction here because the thinking is that we need an affirmative right to vote in the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution has more amendments that address the right to vote than any other right. Yet, legislation like we're seeing today has the ability to strip access to the right to vote. But if you compare, just as the purged Ohio voter purged the right to own a gun to the right to vote, in some states it's easier to get a gun than it is to actually cast a ballot. Mm-hmm. And so we think in certainly the Right to Vote Amendment would affirmatively say that you have the right to vote. And the thinking is certainly that would make it harder for state legislatures to put in these various disenfranchising mechanisms, and that it will finally heighten certainly what should be the central point of our democracy, the right to vote.
You also address in your book how we might modernize the voting process. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Certainly, there is federal legislation. The For the People Act certainly addresses modernization in many ways by saying that we should have automatic voter registration at places like Department of Motor Vehicles, where you're automatically registered to vote. Certainly, we could have an opt-out system as opposed to an opt-in, just like we require young people to sign up for the selective service. How about at 18, persons are automatically registered to vote. And therefore, you have the right to vote. And that's by doing so, we essentially begin to center the right to vote. There's also, you know, discussions, I've been in discussions about whether we should have compulsory voting, meaning that we should compel Americans to vote like they do in other countries like Australia, where you actually have a fine. You have to pay a fine if you don't vote. I believe that we need all kinds of things that we don't need, that there's no silver bullet for this, that we need automatic voter registration. We need early voting. We need no excuse absentee balloting. We need all of these things, and we need to make it easier, not harder.
So, you know, I've always thought that the changing demographics that we read in the news all the time would moderate our politics in future years. And by future years, I was always thinking, 3 to 5 years, maybe 10 years or whatever. And then I read your book and I read the report you give from the Brookings Institution on how and when this will happen. And it's like not anytime soon. And I want you to share with the readers something about that report, just because for those of us who think that we can sit back and wait for demographics to change things in America, and right here in Idaho is a good place to start, those Brookings Institution numbers suggest that we're going to be waiting a long time for that. But again, that's your story, not mine.
I'm so glad you read my book so closely. You have me flipping through the pages now. What did I say exactly? I could certainly tell you something with the chapter on changing demographics essentially points out that the demographics in the United States are changing, but as you point out, not as rapidly, I think, as people assumed. We are becoming more diverse, but because we are becoming more diverse, we're also seeing, I think that is also a reason for a lot of the legislation that we're seeing, and particularly in places like Texas. We certainly saw, I think one of the examples of that would be a Supreme Court case that was brought to only count citizens for redistricting purposes. Historically, in redistricting, you count all persons. In the census, you count all persons. You're not counting citizens. And for redistricting purposes, you're counting, you know, persons over 18. But there was a lawsuit that came out of Texas that essentially said that they only wanted to count particular people. And just by doing that, it was going to hurt young people, people with children. It was also going to hurt communities of color. So we do see these laws that are essentially saying that we want to keep these demographics as they are, and we only want to count certain people. And you see that with the proof of citizenship laws in places like Kansas and Arizona, where they require documentation for citizenship. And you saw courts strike that down, and in particularly in Kansas, where the court said that documentary proof of citizenship law was certainly discriminatory. Mm-hmm. So there have been ways, we have been seeing laws that are trying to impact these changing demographics in ways that would essentially keep the racial dynamics as they are, but the change is coming. The change is certainly coming. I think we saw that in places like Georgia during this last election, where you are seeing certainly a more diverse electorate, and that the choices of, you know, diverse communities are different from white communities in many places. Mm-hmm. And so there's a pushback, and legislation is certainly in many places trying to maintain the status quo. But change is definitely coming. And with the fight for the right to vote certainly continues. And it's certainly a fight in the courts as well as in the legislature, but also on the grassroots level to encourage people and educate people on how to vote, how to register, how to access the right to vote. And I think we're learning that it's not just an election day issue, that it's a 24/7, 365 day approach.
I think your book also makes the point that this isn't just about people of one color. I mean, for that last example you used, redistricting, if we were to allow states to limit the count of people in a district only to citizens, that would be a disastrous blow to the Latino community, for example, wouldn't it?
Yes. And because you're not anticipating certainly that some of those people will become citizens over the next 10 years, right? And that some of those, you know, children that might have been born to non-citizens will turn 18 within this, you know, 10-year period. So, you know, it's a very narrow way of looking at democracy. It's a way that says, you know, democracy is only for certain people. Mm-hmm. And they want to, you know, trying to keep it that way. And that's, you know, that's the fight. That's the fight that we're up against.
Yep. Well, Gilda, the time is up, but this has been a most informative conversation, and the book is even more so because it's longer and covers way more material. We didn't get into felon disenfranchisement, for example, but readers can pick up a copy of this book. It's called Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America by Gilda R. Daniels. Once again, Gilda, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. Don't forget, Reader's Corner is also a podcast. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.